It's to the best of our knowledge from PRX. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and here's a question I never thought I'd ask. Is the nation-state splintering?
Let the thunder sound.
This is producer Shannon Henry Kleiber with...
Xavier Giraud. Xavi and I went to graduate school together, and Xavi is a professor of journalism in Barcelona, and he's from Barcelona.
Great sound effects in this.
It's nearly recalling the bombardments.
Wow. We're walking around the Gothic Quarter, and a huge rainstorm erupted, just a torrential downpour, and ended up in this beautiful small square.
Very small and closed square.
It's called Saint Philippe Neri.
Just has two small narrow streets going out.
Yeah. Cobblestone streets and this beautiful archway and a Baroque church and a fountain. It's kind of romantic and sad because of its history.
Planes from the regime, Italian regime, when Mussolini was in power, they helped Franco, dictator. Mm.
This was in the midst of the Spanish Civil War. Franco was in power, and he was aided by Mussolini and Hitler, and he bombed this beautiful square, and 42 people were killed.
Many of the children were playing in the square, so many were killed by one of these shells that fell. And that's why this square is so famous. And also because the building kept the traces.
There's still shrapnel up against the walls of the church.
That left the bomb.
The shrapnel is in the sides of the building.
Exactly.
So it's kind of like this permanent history on the walls of the church.
Wow.
One reason why I thought it would be interesting to talk in this particular square is because of the parallels today in modern politics in Spain and Catalonia. The week I was there, there were these huge protests by the people who were trying to get independence from Spain, the Catalans. They're trying to break away from Spain and have their own Catalan identity.
It seems like now there's another civil war. It seems like it's happening again.
Yeah. Right. There is a conflict. There's no war, but there is a conflict, a very strong conflict.
They have a different language, a different flag. So when you walk around Barcelona now, you see this Catalan flag everywhere, and you see these yellow ribbons everywhere that people are wearing, or yellow ribbons are graffitied on the walls saying, "We want independence."
That 1st of October, all the world could see thousands and thousands of people going to vote in an election that was considered illegal. The central government is answering with prison and repression. They sent 10,000 policemen to Catalonia. More than 2 million people went to vote.
The government said about the vote that it didn't count. They fired the Catalan government, the president fled, and then was arrested and jailed in Germany.
They are accused of rebellion. In the view of many Catalans, this is an outrage. It's not democracy.
So what will happen next?
Who knows? Who knows? It's quite unpredictable, quite unpredictable.
Producer Shannon Henry Kleiber in Barcelona with journalism professor Xavier Giraud. The future feels unpredictable in so many places today, not just in Spain. And if you look around the world right now, it seems like everybody wants their own independent nation. So are the old nation states toast? Well, that's what John Pfeffer worries about. He directs Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he keeps track of independence movements. He says they're everywhere.
Many of them have been in place for a long time, just as the Catalan movement has been in place. You find a strong movement in Scotland, You can find it in Wales. There's still tension in Belgium between Flanders and Wallonia. Northern Italy, Corsica, those would probably be at the top.
So this is just Europe. Then if we start talking about other places around the world where splintering is happening, It just seems like surely there's a laundry list. Where else?
Well, I mean, obviously, if you look at the major multi-ethnic countries like China and Russia, you'll find quite a number of movements. In China, obviously, Tibet and Xinjiang. Russia, you have Chechnya, you have Dagestan, you have a movement even in Siberia.
And so we haven't even gotten to the Middle East. So,
no.
John, what's going on? I mean, why is this happening now?
Well, in Middle East, if we're talking just about the Middle East, it's certainly the kind of explosion of democratic sentiment, of people kind of rising up against what were very authoritarian governments, Saddam Hussein in Iraq, Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And in part, it's a legacy of lines of demarcation established by colonial empires long ago, plus a war. So the toppling of Saddam Hussein arguably was kind of the first signal that these tyrants are not eternal rulers. And if you add in technology, the ability of people to communicate through Twitter and through other means to organize demonstrations, all of these things, I think, come together to pull at what many would consider to be kind of artificial nation states. In other words, and you could argue that all nation states ultimately are artificial. I mean, the notion of a nation state doesn't really emerge until the 16th or 17th century. Before that, people were perfectly comfortable either identifying as part of an empire, as part of a religion, part of a community, part of a tribe, whatever. But the nation state, over time, constructed a national identity.
So are you saying that it's not just that we're seeing a whole bunch of these little independence movements accidentally? The nation state itself maybe is starting to break down as a model?
Yes. You could argue that the kind of flourishing of the nation state really happens after World War I, the establishment of the countries we now know of in the Middle East, like Syria and Iraq, as well as many of the new countries that emerged from the empires that collapsed at the end of World War I, the Ottoman Empire and so on.
And that was the beginning of the League of Nations, too.
Exactly. And we've seen for the last 20, 30 years, an erosion of the nation state from two different angles, one from above and one from below. From below, you have had movements that have pushed for greater autonomy or independence, but you see also kind of the erosion of nation-state authorities from above.
What do you mean?
So for instance, when countries become part of the European Union, even if they don't give up their currency, they give up a lot of the responsibilities that had hitherto been part of the nation-state's toolbox, if you will. So for instance, if you become part of the European Union, you no longer have the kind of control over the economy that you once had. You have to keep your budget within certain parameters, for instance. You can't do exactly what you want to do in terms of foreign policy because it has to be coordinated with a number of other countries.
So are you saying the European Union itself has kind of weakened the nation state or all those nation states in Europe?
Well, that's an interesting question because on the one hand, it has. On the other hand, it's also created a backlash against that, as countries have said, look, we do not want Brussels to be dictating to us all these things, not only about the size of our budget deficit, but even the length of our cucumbers in terms of European common agricultural policy.
Well, that's why I've read that Brexit was just the beginning. There's also Chexit, Nexit, Italexit.
Exactly. And for Eastern European countries, it's not uncommon to come across the sentiment that, hey, we got rid of Moscow back in 1989. Why do we want to get Brussels to substitute for that?
So it sounds like there are a few things going on, like partly, as we've seen over and over again, witness the Arab Spring, there is something kind of viral about independence movements once they get started. One thing I don't understand about the timing, though, is that this is all happening really within the decade or so after the internet really took off. And the internet was supposed to erase geographic and cultural divisions and bring us all together. But it seems like it's had the opposite effect.
It once was said among sociologists that technology would bring people together and basically bind people once they got to know each other, you know? And it turned out, in fact, empirically, that once people got to know each other, they started to stress their differences, not their commonalities.
We're becoming much more tribal.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been talking about other countries splintering, countries across the oceans from us. What about in the U.S.? There was a time when people made jokes about, oh, Vermont might secede or Texas or California, but is it time to stop joking?
Well, if you look at what's happening in California, yes, California is by itself a powerful economy. A lot of people there are not happy with what the federal government is doing under Donald Trump. There are a number of lawsuits that have been launched against federal policy, and the federal government, in some sense, has reacted in order to bring California in line, or at least the communities in California that are most rebellious. One could imagine that that trend could accelerate. But I'm actually worried about a different form of secession, not so much territorial secession, but secession from the public good. In other words, when people decide, for instance, that the public education system is no longer viable, at least viable for them and their children, and they pull children out of that public education system, either for them to be privately educated in academies or to be homeschooled. Mm. And if a public education system collapses in that way, then the nation state, in fact, has no means of reproducing itself. Because, in fact, that's where you learn that you are part of a nation, through the public education system.
So it's sort of like cultural secession can start the movement, and we might not even really sort of notice it happening until it's too late. Isn't that how civil wars start?
You could call it dead nation walking. In other words, you could have the United States moving along this path without our even knowing it. In fact, even perhaps seeing other signs of nation state health.
Okay, well, let me play devil's advocate here for a minute. I'm not sure it would be such a bad thing for a bunch of states to decide to secede. Maybe instead of trying to cooperate and get along, we could just say, you know what? People in Texas are just really different from people in Vermont, and maybe they should just all be their own little nations.
I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that. And at a certain point, for instance, between Czechs and Slovaks, you have to say, look, they tried to get along, you know, between 1990 and 1993, and it just didn't work out. Let's say that we're in a situation in which people from Maine and people from Texas agree to have an amicable divorce. There's a referendum, and it's clear that this is the political will. I would not be one to step in and say, well, you're wrong, you know, for a variety of reasons. However, if I looked at it more globally, I would say, look, we're in a moment right now in the world where we face problems that have to be dealt with globally by people working together. And in order to address an issue like global warming, it becomes that much more difficult to get everybody on board the more players you have at the table. I mean, if you look at the Paris Accords, it was extraordinarily difficult to get big states and small states to sit down and agree.
Are there any alternative models to the nation state? Any other way of organizing people?
Well, you can go one of two directions. You can go to the communitarian side. And the anarchists, of course, have popularized this notion of these kind of sustainable communities that communicate with one another on an ad hoc basis. The one place in the world where that concept has had the most currency is in Syria, in the Kurdish area in the north of Syria, which has actually followed some of the anarchist philosophies, in particular of Murray Bookchin from Vermont.
That's fascinating.
Exactly. And then, of course, the more popular model was the one we all thought was going to gain greater currency, and that is a United Nations, one that at least would have greater democratic authority to deal with global issues. Now, the United Nations, in practice, has fallen short of that ideal, even though it has done some tremendous things around the world. But in between, well, we thought that the European Union would be precisely this kind of mechanism where nation states kind of cede a certain amount of authority to a central government. And at this moment, at least, it seems unlikely that that's going to go forward, until the European Union figures out how to deal with its current problems, in terms of its economy, the press of immigration, and how to reconcile identity issues within the European space.
It sounds like, from what you're saying, that the nation state still may be the very best model for preventing everyone from just retreating into their separate cultural and religious tribes.
Well, the nation state still has a monopoly on violence. One of the reasons why the nation state survives, why it's proven to be such an effective form of organization, is that it has the power. It has the military power. It doesn't allow its citizens to form posses, if you will, that will challenge its authority. And if there's an aggression from outside, it becomes the place to defend its territory.
So, John, if you had to sort of give a prescription for how do you make a nation state strong and vital while also ensuring that it stays pluralistic and it doesn't demonize immigrants or minority communities?
It's a tough question. In order to kind of have a viable nation state, in my opinion, you have to have a kind of ever-renewing democracy. In other words, a democracy in which people actually are fundamentally engaged on an everyday level at all levels of democratic life. In other words, their community level, their state or province level, and at the federal level. If they lose faith in any of those levels, then I think the nation state as a whole begins to atrophy. But it's extremely difficult to manage that democratic excitement of getting involved. You can have it at the beginning of a nation state, you know, when the Czech Republic becomes independent. Whoa, everyone's really excited about that. We finally have our independence. But you begin to fall back into older modes of non-engagement as time goes on, and will only become engaged if there's a threat. Obviously, in this current political environment, a lot of people see the Trump administration as a threat, and that gets them democratically involved, running for office, getting involved in a variety of different ways. That's great, but the real challenge is to remain democratically engaged in otherwise boring political times.
John Pfeffer directs Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. He also wrote a dystopian novel about where we may be headed called Splinterlands. Coming up, becoming an independent nation is one task. Establishing a national identity is another.
Aap apne bachchon ke saath is a part of you that is a little foreign. You're a little foreign to them, and they're a little foreign to you. Because they are growing up as a new product. Jaise crossbreed nahi hota between the old and the new culture.
Producer Halima Shah takes us to Pakistan. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We've been talking about the drive to independence, about how many nation states are splintering or eroding, borders being redrawn all over the world. But that's just the beginning. Establishing a national identity, a collective set of ideals, morals, beliefs, that takes years, decades even. You could say that the work of nation building is never really done. Halima Shah has been thinking about that after a recent trip to a country close to her heart, Pakistan.
I went to Pakistan for the first time in 12 years. I went as a kid. My parents were born and raised there, and then they had me in the U.S., where I was brought up. And when I went back this time, it was my first time there, one, as an adult, and two, as an American journalist. Anyone who visits has a pretty good chance of seeing Charing Cross. It's the center point in the city, this major landmark in Lahore and for Pakistan. It's always kind of been this point where there's a lot of political rallies and marches. And a few months ago, there were actually motorists complaining that there were so many sit-ins at Charing Cross, it was hard to even get anywhere. I encountered it when I was actually covering International Women's Day. There was a march to Charing Cross. It was also a site for darker things. There was a bombing nearby in 2017. It has a really interesting history, too. When you go to the square, you see this marble canopy. And for a long time, in the 1900s, there was this enormous bronze statue of Queen Victoria. It was a statue of her wearing a widow's veil and an apron, and it looked like it was bigger than, like, the actual Queen Victoria.
Well, she was little, so.
Yeah, exactly. The statue's gone now. It came down in the 1950s, and it was placed there in the early 1900s.
The height of the British colonial period.
Exactly. And I thought, okay, well, this is a country that eventually became an independent country and wanted to shed its colonial past. I was wondering if she had been melted and turned into something else. I talked to Ali Osman Qasmi. He's a historian of modern South Asia. And one of the things he told me was what ended up happening to Queen Victoria's statue.
It's been moved to Lahore Museum's basement.
She's in the basement?
I know what it sounds like, but it's still available for public viewing.
Colonial era monuments, some of them were removed from public viewing, some of them were shipped off to England, and some of them are still in Pakistan.
Now, what you see at the center of Charing Cross, under this marble canopy, is a bronze replica of the Quran.
That's a monument which was built to commemorate the Islamic summit, which took place in 1974, to celebrate the general feeling or aspiration which was there in Pakistan to bring about some kind of unity among Muslim countries.
So you have to keep in mind that Pakistan was founded as a haven for Muslims in South Asia. When the British Raj came to an end, the partition took place. The region was divided into two nations. There was Hindu-majority India and Muslim-majority Pakistan.
But the partition was deeply traumatic.
It was extremely traumatic. It was the largest mass migration in human history. And in Pakistan, you're always a stone's throw away from a story about a relative who was kidnapped on the road, or someone who might have died, or someone who might have seen these trains with tons and tons of dead bodies. The memory of this time is so alive.
Wow. Does your family have personal memories of that time?
Yeah. My grandmother is from the partition generation. She was a student at the University of Punjab around that time. She was very supportive of the two-state solution. She was, you know, one of many student protesters who was arrested for civil disobedience and jailed for a while and later on released. And then my mom is from that first generation to actually be born in present-day Pakistan. And she and my father both left the country and built their lives in the United States. I'm that third generation that feels some tie to this country, but at the same time feels like something of a foreigner in it, too.
Chai dal do?
Yes, please.
This is my mom and me having breakfast.
Do you feel at home when you come back to Lahore?
Quite at home.
The faces are like you. The dress is like you. The food is like what you eat.
I feel kind of like a foreigner still.
You probably do.
But you still feel comfortable.
It feels like this is me. It's like your bedroom. You've been away for months and you come back and it's still your bedroom.
Even though this isn't your childhood home.
No. The country is like your bedroom.
Do I hear tea being poured?
Yeah. I didn't have to eat because I had like 6 cups of tea a day. Every single time you go to an interview in Pakistan, people are very hospitable and they pour you tea.
Sounds like you and your mom are going back and forth between English and Urdu.
Yeah, Pakistani Americans do that a lot. But then when you're in Pakistan, you also will notice that English is sprinkled a lot into Urdu conversation. And I think that's partly why I was somewhat curious about Charing Cross. You start to see certain relics of British influence in day-to-day Pakistani life, and you start to wonder what happens to the British past? What happened to the Indian past? What happens when you get your nation state? What happens after that point?
There's a typical post-colonial situation.
This is Tahir Kamran. He's a historian who's studied Pakistan and Lahore's political history.
All the post-colonial states and societies, when they're in the need of constructing their own narrative, anything antithetical to their native sense of nationalism have to be removed.
Like Queen Victoria's statue.
The very presence of Queen Victoria, who was not Muslim, who was no longer alive, you know, according to diehard scholars or clerics of Islam, she represented Christianity. Her statue had no business to be perched there at Charing Cross.
When I asked him about the statue at Charing Cross, he actually went much further back to the founding of Pakistan. And what he basically said was that this country, it was built on a really futuristic vision. It wasn't necessarily rooted in the past.
As you know, of the many races, creeds, and religions that inhabit the vast subcontinent of India, there are 2 major nations, the Hindus and Muslims.
This is a speech from Pakistan's founding father and first leader, Muhammad Ali Jinnah.
We want the division of India into Hindustan and Pakistan because that is the only practical solution which will secure...
Jinnah didn't make any allusion to history while he was launching a struggle for a separate state for the Muslims.
But freedom must mean freedom both from the British exploitation and Hindu domination. 100 millions of Muslims will never agree merely to a change of masters.
So are you saying that Pakistan was really struggling with what does it mean to be a Muslim nation? Do we want to be a Muslim nation? Are we a nation that's very friendly to Muslims? Or are we an actual theocracy?
Those questions are still being asked. You talk to Pakistanis and everyone seems to have a different answer sometimes about what Pakistan was supposed to be when it was seen as a haven for Muslims. Was it supposed to be a secular vision for minority groups in the country, many of whom were Muslim? Or was it supposed to be a theocracy? Or was it just supposed to be this country that had a lot of Muslims in it? And you'll get varying answers. So let's go back to the 1970s for a second. Pakistan is a new country. And the country has a prime minister. His name is Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. And his administration is getting criticized and is being called irreligious. So I talked to Amjad Abbas Khan about this. He's a political scientist who's also based in Lahore.
Unfortunately, in Pakistan, you see that religion is mostly used for political gains. So to appease and to win the support of that class, he posed himself as the torchbearer of Muslim unity and Muslim Ummah, as the leader of the Muslim world.
So he aligned himself with major Muslim majority countries, and he held this massive summit in Lahore. One of the people he invites is King Faisal of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is this oil-rich Gulf country, so there is a geopolitical benefit to doing this too. And to commemorate this summit, he placed a bronze replica of the Quran at Charing Cross, and then Charing Cross gets renamed. It's called Faisal Square, but also no one calls it that.
So this Quran sitting there is not actually so much a religious artifact as it is a political artifact.
If you believe Amjad Abbas Khan...
Basically, it was politically motivated.
Outside the world of politics and large monuments and political parties, you were there hanging out with your mom. More tea?
Yeah, oh my God, tea every day, all the time.
Did those questions of sort of what is Pakistan come up at all?
Absolutely. I think one of the common experiences with a lot of immigrants is that the country is one way when you leave it, and then when you come back, it's not exactly as it used to be. And I think one of the things that shocked my mom when she went back was that Iqbal, who is this poet and philosopher who is considered the spiritual founder of Pakistan, his poetry was so ubiquitous during her childhood, and kids used to recite it every morning before school.
Zindagi shamma ki surat ho khudaya mere dur duniya se mere dam se andhera ho jaye. The darkness of the world goes away. Make my life like a candle. Ye meri dua hai ki make my life like a candle so I can cast away the shadows of this world.
And she was having a conversation with some of my cousins, and they didn't seem as aware of Iqbal and his work as she was, or as people of her generation were.
Iqbal ki jo poetry hai, it's a philosophy of life, a recognition of who a human being is.
And how about you? I mean, what was the emotional impact for you of the trip? I mean, we've talked about intellectually how you began to kind of think more deeply about Pakistan's political history and national identity. Did it make you feel more Pakistani or more separate?
I think I've just always identified with a third category. I think oftentimes this question is asked of first-generation Americans, are you more X or are you more Y? Are you more Pakistani or are you more American? And it's kind of like such a false binary. What I've always identified as is Pakistani-American. So home is not in Pakistan, and it's not necessarily in certain parts of the United States. It's that space with my friends where we're kind of cracking jokes that are both drawing on the things that our parents told us and the things that are in American popular culture. To say, like, my identity is based on what's on my passport or which country I'm physically in, it's kind of a misunderstanding of what national borders are, because national borders try to keep some things out and some things in, but what they've never really been able to do is stop the flow of culture or ideas.
That's To the Best of Our Knowledge producer Halima Shah with a story from Pakistan. You know, one thing I found really interesting in her story is the way the concept of national identity changes across generations. So there's another resident of Lahore, writer Mohsen Hamid, who thinks that's not an accident.
Almost everywhere I've encountered among younger people more open-mindedness, more willingness to accept difference than older people. And the way that humanity evolves is that the older people will pass. And as they do, more closed-minded values are going to go. We need to once again accept transience and change as the fundamental nature of what human life looks like.
Mohsen Hamid imagines a world in which national borders are obsolete. After this, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
We started this hour with a question. Is the nation state splintering? Well, for 65.6 million people around the world, it already has. That's the number of people currently displaced, forced from home by war or conflict or persecution. And to put this in perspective, that's nearly 20 people a minute. Well, the novelist Mohsen Hamid sees the global refugee crisis as both a tragedy and an opportunity. Hamid is an internationally admired writer. He's known for tackling big issues like globalization and fundamentalism in fiction. His newest novel, Exit West, is set in a world of permanent mass migration. It's a love story, which begins in a city ripped apart by civil war. He told Steve Paulson it's modeled in part on his own country, Pakistan, and here's how it begins.
In a city swollen by refugees, but still mostly at peace, or at least not yet openly at war, a young man met a young woman in a classroom and did not speak to her for many days. His name was Saeed and her name was Nadia, and he had a beard. And she was always clad from the tips of her toes to the bottom of her jugular notch in a flowing black robe. Back then, people continued to enjoy the luxury of wearing more or less what they wanted to wear. And so these choices meant something. It might seem odd that in cities teetering at the edge of the abyss, young people still go to class. But that is the way of things, with cities as with life. For one moment, we are pottering about our errands as usual, and the next, we are dying. And our eternally impending ending does not put a stop to our transient beginnings and middles until the instant when it does.
Oh, that is a great setup. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Mohsen, your novels typically deal with very loaded subjects, and this one revolves around the refugee crisis and the explosion of migrants around the world. Why did you want to take on this topic?
I think that I've been migrating my whole life geographically. I came to California from Pakistan when I was 3, went back to Pakistan when I was 9, came to America at 18, London at 30, back to Pakistan at 38. And so the growing anti-migrant rhetoric that you're seeing all over the world is something I take personally. And I wanted to write a novel that began to explore the idea that not only are migrants not villains, but that actually everyone is a migrant and that it's a universal part of the human condition to migrate.
Why is everyone a migrant? I mean, the refugees, I understand, but what about the rest of us?
Well, I think that what happens in our lives is that we migrate through time. So in a sense, we're each a refugee from our own childhood. You know, the school we went to, the people we played with, those things will have all changed. Some dispersed, some people will have passed away. And we can't return to that time. And we feel a sense of loss and we feel that things change. And things continue to change throughout our lives. And we often try to deny the sorrow and loss that occurs by migrating in time in this way. But I think that's a mistake. It's better to acknowledge that feeling and to see how it unites us with people who migrate also across geographies. Hmm.
So can you tell me about your two main characters, Saeed and Nadia?
Saeed and Nadia are two young people in an unnamed city that is about to descend into civil war. And they meet in an evening class. Saeed is very close to his parents and quietly religious in a way. And Nadia is somebody who has broken with her family, who wants to reinvent herself and who's resolutely looking towards the future into something different. They're quite different from each other, but they meet and they fall for each other. And the story of the novel is the story of their relationship.
And the city where they live is never named. Why did you make that choice?
Partly so that the reader could imagine into that city. I based the city on Lahore, Pakistan, where I live, but undergoing tragic circumstances, violent circumstances, which fortunately Lahore has not been through. I didn't have the heart, really, to give their city's name the name of my city.
So this unnamed city in your novel becomes a war zone. It's like some of the cities we read about in Syria. Bombs go off routinely. People get hauled away in the middle of the night or executed because they don't have the right politics or the right religion. Have you been personally touched by this kind of violence?
When you live in a place like Lahore in Pakistan, where I live, it's not like Damascus or Baghdad. But like those cities, people in Lahore will know of someone who's been affected by a bombing or by an attack or by an assassination.
What about you? Do you know anyone who's...
Yeah, well, my mother-in-law's best friend, her husband was the governor of our province, and he spoke out in favor of the rights of minorities and Christians in particular. He was assassinated. Assassinated by his own bodyguard, who accused him of blasphemy.
That must hit home for you.
I don't want to give the impression that Lahore is a particularly violent city, but political violence has touched people there.
Now, what I find so interesting about your personal history, you already mentioned, is that you moved back to Pakistan after living in both America and London. As you say, you've been a migrant yourself.
Yeah, my wife and I, shortly after the birth of our first child, my wife is also from Lahore, we started wondering whether if we didn't go back now, would we maybe never go back? And we thought we'd go and see, did we still like it? Would we be happy there? And that was 8 years ago. And living in Pakistan, I can't say has been, you know, always easy. And sometimes I feel almost foreign in Pakistan, in the same way that I feel almost foreign in America or Britain.
Almost foreign in what regard?
Well, you know, I'm such a mongrel now and such a mix of things that I never feel, I suppose, entirely at home anywhere. But one thing which I've found as I get older is that that sense of being a bit different, a bit foreign, a bit out of place, allows me to connect with other people because I've come to understand that almost everybody feels a little bit out of place for different reasons. The only daughter in a family with five sons or the only gay child in a family where everybody else is straight. People, for so many different reasons, can feel foreign.
And one of the things that you get into in your novel is this eruption of different factions sort of fighting with each other. I'm thinking, for instance, about independence movements that are popping up all over the place. Catalonia in Spain, Scotland wanting to secede from the UK, Quebec in Canada, places that have distinct cultural identities. And I guess I'm wondering if you see these kinds of movements as problems, places that really don't want to be part of the larger nation state that they are legally bound to.
These sorts of secessionist movements, I mean, I have a position on them based on the experience of Pakistan. Pakistan, in a way, was the original 20th century state formed on religious lines. British Imperial India was divided up into Hindu-majority India and Muslim-majority Pakistan in 1947. And since then, what we've seen is Pakistan has become ever increasingly less tolerant of other viewpoints. Who is Muslim enough to be Pakistani has become more and more contested. We imagine that we can take countries and break them into smaller parts, and those smaller parts will be much easier to manage. It isn't always the case. It can be the case. We have to imagine that these smaller countries are not being formed on the basis of a kind of ethnic identity, but they're being formed on a more inclusive promise that says that everybody in this new state belongs. But too often we're seeing something else happen. Now, that doesn't mean you should never split countries, but I think the potential violence and the potential devastation that can occur are very real. And you probably shouldn't walk down that path unless the current situation is itself so violent and unbearable that you can't stand it any longer.
And I also get the sense from your novel that you see this situation with refugees and migrants now as truly being a global crisis that we really have barely begun to grasp.
Yes, I think that the direction of human history is the direction of greater equality. Many of us believe that regardless of your race, you should be treated equally, regardless of your gender, regardless of your sexual orientation or your religious beliefs or lack of religious beliefs, you should be treated equally. And I think that now the idea that somebody born in Milwaukee and somebody born in Mogadishu, two children, should have fundamentally different rights about how they can live, where they can live, and the child in Mogadishu should stay there in the face of violence and potentially die just because of the lottery of where they were born, that position is going to become more and more untenable. And in 200 or 300 years' time, people are going to look back at us, the people of today, who denied refugees access and denied migrants access, and think that we are as barbaric as we think that slaveholders were, who treated black slaves, African-American slaves, as subhuman.
Sounds like you're saying that we need to get rid of national borders. People should just be able to live wherever they want.
Well, look, national borders are pretty new. Until 100 years ago, there weren't any passports. People moved around. It's not like the nation state with the existing border system and immigration checks has been there since the beginning of time. People used to move. It's a new thing. And I think the real model shouldn't be our countries. It should be our cities. You can move to New York from somewhere else and become a New Yorker. Cities grant, in a sense, their city citizenship so easily. If you abide by the rules and work hard or join society, you can belong to a city. And just so you know, the vast majority of migration in the world today isn't from poor countries to rich countries. It's from the countryside of poor countries to the cities of poor countries, like Lahore, which had 3 million people when I was born, and 11 million people today. And Lahore is managing. And I think that countries can too.
Yeah, there's sort of a paradox here that I hear you talking about. I mean, on the one hand, you're celebrating the values of the global citizen. People should be able to move anywhere they want. There shouldn't be strict boundaries. We're all in this together. And yet, for a lot of people, the very idea of globalization, it's kind of a dirty word now. It conjures up visions of multinational companies moving into a country, wiping out homegrown industries, global capitalism, which seems to widen the gap between the rich and the poor. Does this seem really complicated to you as well?
Well, I think that there's two different things, right? There's global capitalism that currently functions, and there's how people move. I don't think they're the same thing. We actually have enormous restrictions on how people move and enormous freedom on how capital moves. And so most of what we call globalization actually is economic globalization. It's not the people moving. But I want to make one thing clear. I don't think of myself as a kind of global citizen, rootless person who sort of drifts around the world. I grew up in a house in Lahore where my grandparents, my parents, and we children and cousins live together in an extended family. I live in that same house. I live in an environment very similar to the one I grew up in. I understand that there is an attraction to the past and there's an attraction to family, there's an attraction to where we come from. But I wouldn't use my living in that way as a way to say that other people should not be allowed to come to Lahore. And I think that the economics of it, in fact, could be better if we allowed people to move but regulated our businesses more thoroughly.
We've been talking about a lot of political issues here. Of course, you are best known as a fiction writer. What can a novelist do to help us think about these issues?
I think that there's a reason why we have storytelling. Storytelling liberates us from the tyranny of what has come before and what is now and allows us to imagine what could be. And I think that's incredibly important, right, to sort of begin to imagine what could be. But storytelling also allows us to cross the borders of our own self. When you read a book, you're sitting by yourself all alone. You have your thoughts. And in the same place where you have your thoughts, there are the thoughts of somebody else, the writer, coming in the form of this book. And so in that moment, you are you, but yet you have somebody else's thoughts inside you. And I think that's an incredibly fertile and beautiful and productive and interesting space for human beings to occupy. And that fiction has the power to make us transcend ourselves, question ourselves, connect with other selves in unique ways.
It sounds like you're talking about the capacity to create empathy, to give us a window into other people who are not like us.
Absolutely. I think that fiction does have the capacity to create empathy, but I think fiction also has the capacity to blur our own sense of self. When we read about being a woman, if we are a man, or being from a different country, if we are from this one, it's not only that we feel a sense of empathy for that other person. Our own sense of who we are begins to blur, right? We occupy this fictional world for a while. We sort of dress ourselves up and play make-believe in our imaginations in a different world. And when you play make-believe, you are changed. When you come back into the world of quote-unquote reality, the world after reading the book, you're not the same person who went in. So yes, there's empathy, but also there's a kind of personal transformation that fiction does to each of us because we imagine different things.
I have to say, one of the things that I really loved about your novel is there's so much grimness along the way as your characters are fleeing and desperately trying to find a new place to call home and not just sort of living out of their suitcases. And there's all this violence and difficulty, but in the end, there's hope. The message in the end is the value of crossing borders, of meeting people, different people, not like you. Is that the message you wanted us to take away?
Yeah, because I think in a way what happens is that we imagine that the person who has left their country and is fearful of where they've arrived, a different place, and the person who is fearful in their own country of new people coming and making themselves foreign in their own country of their birth, that these are two very different things. They're not different things. I don't think somebody who's scared of migrants and scared of change is necessarily a kind of racist xenophobe. I think that both people, the migrant and the person who's afraid of migrants, are afraid of change and of how life transitions and of how things move on. The antidote to that is not to say that one group of people is horrific and that we should fight some battle with each other until only one side survives. The antidote is to understand that these are the human feelings of loss that we all share in, recognize that in each other, and try collectively to build a more hopeful world, which is hopefully the spirit that the novel ends in.
That's novelist Mohsen Hamid talking with Steve Paulson. His new novel, Exit West, was a finalist for the Man Booker Prize. And that's it for this hour. If you joined us partway and missed some of it, you'll find richer versions of all the stories on our website at ttbook.org. And while you're there, make sure to sign up for our weekly newsletter. It's full of background stuff, news and notes, all kinds of things that never make it to air. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced in Madison by Wisconsin Public Radio, and specifically by Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers, Halima Shah, and Shannon Henry Kleiber. Joe Hartke is our sound designer and technical producer. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strangehamps. Thanks for spending time with us. Till next time. Thank you.